from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not hard to see a presidential election as important, maybe the most important ever. Americans saw their vote that way in 1828 and 1860. In times of depression, in times of war, Richard Nixon described 1960's vote as the most important ever. Rush Limbaugh said the same of 2000. But there is something about next Tuesday's vote in November of 2004 that has many Americans feeling this one is different, a real fork in the road, the most important vote in a very long time. Tonight on Point, we'll look at why, with Pulitzer Prize winners David Kennedy and David Halberstam, and a major voice on the right, Midge Dechter, asking each of them and you, what is riding on this vote for America and the world? You can join us. How do you size up the importance, the consequence of Election 04? Just how important is this vote and why? What do you see at stake next Tuesday? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is David Kennedy, professor of history at Stanford University and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War. He's also co-author of The American Pageant, A History of the Republic. David Kennedy, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here with you.
You're a wonderful historian, and you've seen how Americans respond to presidential elections, and you know in retrospect that there really are some key ones. You must have felt, as we have here, that a lot of people are feeling that way about this year's election. Is it, as an historian, is it possible, less than a week in advance of an election, to have a sense of its consequence, or are we just blowing smoke trying?
Well, I certainly agree with the sense or the impression that's widespread in the country that this is a peculiarly consequential election. And in fact, you mentioned, Tom, two 19th century elections, 1828. Election of Andrew Jackson, 1860, the election of Abraham Lincoln. Mm. As it happens, those are two elections in a very small set of elections that historians and political scientists have identified as so-called key elections, when there were tectonic shifts, seismic shifts in the nature of the political landscape, elections that created whole new constellations of political configurations and arrangements and substantially changed the practice of politics.
We're going to talk
the others are.
We'll talk a lot tonight about this election, but maybe take us back to a couple of those, David. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You must be thinking of others. I don't know, 1932.
Well, the usual set is 1828, Andrew Jackson, 1860, yeah. Abraham Lincoln, 1896, William McKinley.
Mm-hmm. Against William Jennings Bryan in 96.
Exactly. In 1932, Franklin Roosevelt wins over Herbert Hoover. Now, there's a peculiarity about these the cycle of these things that you may have noticed, that they're separated by and large by about a 3.5-decade interval.
Yeah.
And if you project the numbers forward after 1932, the next of the elections that should have fallen into this cyclical pattern should have been 1968. And indeed, there was a very influential book published by Kevin Phillips at that time, mm-hmm. called The Emerging Republican Majority, that used this theory of the cyclicity of American elections to predict that 68 would be an election of this type. Now, there's a lot of debate amongst historians and political scientists whether or not it was. But let's just say for purposes of argument that it was some kind of a defining election, and the cycle thus holds. That would bring us 36 years later to 2004. So in a sense, the election of 2004 falls with an almost eerie precision into this cycle that's long since been identified as about a 3.5-decade long cycle.
Right on schedule.
Political regimes play themselves out.
So we may be on to something. Just to give us a sense of comparative scale, give us the quick shorthand on each of those key elections that you just cited to give us a sense of what you mean by tectonic plate shifts. In tiny abbreviation, what were the big forks in the road or shifts that we saw in those?
Well, Jackson's election definitively kills off the old Federalist Party and ushers in an era when the principal issues are territorial expansion to the West, the Mexican War, and slavery and abolition. Mm. Lincoln's election definitively establishes the Republican Party as a major party, takes up the issue of slavery, of course, wins the Civil War. and ushers in the era of Reconstruction thereafter. McKinley's election, definitively, after a period of quite even contest between Democrats and Republicans, establishes the Republicans as the dominant party until Herbert Hoover loses it in 1932 to Roosevelt. Roosevelt's election makes the Democrats the dominant party, makes the principal issues the creation, at least, of the rudiments of a welfare state and internationalism and foreign policy. On those elections and those political regimes, so-called, there's pretty good agreement. The contest or the argument really comes as to whether 1968 falls into the pattern.
Right. I suppose that's probably more than enough right there. In each of these, if the vote had gone differently, American history would have been quite different.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And that's why there are these moments when history can turn, when the curve of history can inflect very, very dramatically. So there's good reason, I think. It's not just the cry of the punditocracy. I think there's good historical grounds on which to consider this election perhaps one of those, potentially at least one of those turning points.
So we're going to hear from our callers, from Midge Dechter, from David Halberstam, but I'd like to hear first from you, David Kennedy, looking at next Tuesday, looking at this moment, falling on cycle, as you describe it. If you had to outline the fork in the road or the choices that may give this election such scale, such magnitude, how would you do it?
Well, I think fundamentally what's at stake in this election is a national attitude about risk, about whether I think one of the candidates, George Bush, I think, is very risk tolerant, both in domestic and foreign affairs. The other candidate, Senator Kerry, I think, is much more risk averse, much more prudent in his approach to issues, more thoughtful. Bush is a plunger. He's a risk taker. History may judge that kind of risk-taking to be bold and successful, or it may judge it to be quite reckless. But I think both in domestic and foreign policy, we're really at a point where we have to decide how much risk we're willing to tolerate. Do we want to shift the burden of risk from the society at large to individuals, for example, in managing their retirement accounts? The current system places a lot of responsibility on us collectively, and it's been part of the Bush and the Republican Party strategy to shift that burden of risk to individuals in a substantial degree. In foreign policy, do we want to run the risk of going it alone in the world, which is the hallmark of the Bush administration's policy, or do we want to re-embrace the kinds of multilateralist and cooperative policies that have served us, I think, in my judgment, quite well in the 60 years or so since World War II.
But in a way, risk is a mode. When one plunges or doesn't plunge, it's either toward or not toward something. Do you also see that kind of fork in the road, not just about a style of American leadership or imposition, depending how you look at it, but the direction?
Well, yes. I think it's quite clear. Let's just talk about the realm of foreign policy or foreign relations to make the case simple. But it seems to me it's quite clear that there are, despite the superficial similarity of rhetoric between Bush and Kerry, I think there are deep differences, philosophical differences, about just what should be this country's posture toward the rest of the world. And I think the Bush administration is far more comfortable acting preemptively and unilaterally for reasons that they are prepared to defend, obviously. But I think a Kerry administration would be much more inclined to rely upon those kinds of mechanisms that have kept the peace of the world, by and large, for the last six decades. There's been no grand war between the great powers or major powers for six decades. That actually is an unusually long interval in the history of the modern world for that kind of peace to prevail. And it's that kind of those kinds of multilateral and cooperative relationships which have undergirded, underwritten the regime that we've now coined a new word to describe, the regime of globalization, which has increased the standard of living of peoples the world over, has prospered this country tremendously. I'm thinking of the whole lattice work of multilateral institutions that were grew out of the end of World War II,
right.
The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which morphs into the World Trade Organization in the 1990s. All of these arrangements that have helped to increase the flow of capital, of commerce, even the flow of people and cultural products, for that matter. This has made the modern world that we live in what it is.
But George Bush is making the case that we're facing a new reality, and we may have to take some risks in order to keep things rolling, even if they're rolling in a different direction. David Kennedy in California, we should stand by for just a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York, Midge Dechter. She's an essayist and social critic, author of Rumsfeld, as in Donald Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld, A Personal Portrait, former editor at Harper's Magazine and Saturday Review. She's a member of the board of the Heritage Institute, 2003 recipient of the National Humanities Medal. Midge Dechter, thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, I'm very pleased to be here.
So you see what we're on to here tonight. A lot of people feeling like this is a very important election, maybe the most important. Dick Cheney says one of the most important, not just in our lives, but in our history. John Kerry, of course, at the Democratic National Convention, saying the most important election of our lifetime. Bruce Springsteen calling it the most important election of our lifetime. How do you see this election stack up in terms of its significance, Midge Dechter, and why?
Well, it is certainly one of the most important in my lifetime. I'm not sure that it's more important than the election of 1948, which produced the Truman presidency and a new role for the United States in the world. I was fascinated. I was listening to just a last couple of minutes of the professor's
David Kennedy.
David Kennedy's speech, and I found it fascinating. There was only one thing that I would say against what he said, and that is that it's not only the United States which has, under Bush, which is assuming a new role, it's that the other players with whom we used to play, when there were agreements and arrangements and so on, they have also changed. And
you're talking about European allies in particular?
Yeah, they're France and Germany primarily. They're in a state of serious decline, which makes them. It's not a matter of theory. It makes them very questionable allies in any case.
Mitch Dechter, I wish you'd put some meat on the bones of this notion that this is a big election. That tends to suggest a fork in the road. If it's a fork in the road, you see, and a consequential one, what are the two tines of that fork, if there are two? What are the two directions, the options?
Well, I'm not so sure. It's certainly very important, but I'm not so sure it's a complete fork in the road, because I'm not so sure that if John Kerry were elected, he would be able to sustain the kind of presidency that it appears and that Professor Kennedy thinks would be the natural presidency for him.
You're saying the past is gone. You can't go back to
that. Well, there are. I don't know. I'm not sure. But there certainly are conditions now which might make it necessary even for a president who had no intention of doing so, of taking the United States and continuing its role as the single power in the world, which is, after all, the truth about relative powers. And that is a terrible burden. It's also an opportunity. And it's a burden that the United States has carried for a long time. And in my opinion, carried to the great benefit of very large numbers of people around the world.
So when you see George Bush prepared, as David Kennedy describes him, to take risks to pick up that leadership in a very assertive way, you're applauding that.
Oh, yes, of course I'm applauding it. But it was, you made it sound as if he's just a risk taker. In fact, there's a wave of terror going on in the world. He has taken up the cause of fighting this war against terror. This involves fighting powers in the world and fighting unseen forces, and it's a very messy business. I'm not so sure I would call it a risk. After all, we were hit by the terrorists. And we've now had the experience of understanding how serious a phenomenon this is and is going to be unless a stop is put to it.
Midge Dechter, David Kennedy, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We can hear some forks in the road being described here. We're talking about next Tuesday's election and just how important it is, the most important in a generation, in decades, in U.S. history. and why, my guest David Kennedy at Stanford University, Midge Dechter, essayist and social critic, author of Rumsfeld, A Personal Portrait. You can join us as well. How do you size up the consequence of the 2004 presidential election? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about next Tuesday's election, just a few days away now, and exactly how important it is. You can join the conversation tonight. Are the stakes greater than average here? How much greater and why? How does this vote stack up to other presidential elections you've voted in? And on November 2nd, 2004, is the country at a fork in the road? How would you define it in big terms for the country and the world? What do you think will be decided next week? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking with Midge Dechter, who's joining us from New York, and David Kennedy from Stanford, California. David Kennedy, Midge Dechter is acknowledging, saying, yes, indeed, it looks like a big election to me, but it may not exactly be a fork in the road. The old fork, as she would describe it, may be gone. Bush may have the only viable way forward.
Well, I share Midge Dechter's sense of prudence and hesitation to label this ahead of time, especially the most important election of our lifetime, though I agree with her and with the premise of your question that this is a highly important election. Mm. I think the unstated premise of her comment was that 9/11 changed everything, and that a comment that's been frequently heard in the last 3 years, and that this election, since it's the first election in the age of terror, so-called, has a peculiar salience. I guess my settled feeling after living in the age of terror for 3 years is that 9/11 changed a lot of things, but did not, in fact, change everything. And we have a broader and deeper set of relationships in the world that have been time-tested, that have served us well and served others well, and that to abandon those or to put them at risk, put them in jeopardy, because of the trauma of 9/11 is probably not the most prudent course. So I'm not as convinced as some others that the war on terror has been effectively waged in that context.
Mr. Dechter, there's a vote against that way forward.
I'd like to say that September 11th was not should not have been a shock. It was the last of a series of things to which the United States should have paid more attention. The war, the war from the terrorist side has been going on for quite a while now, and they just got nervier and nervier because of our lack of taking action. And September 11th was the culmination of that, it seems to me. And not just, it shouldn't have been like a lightning strike.
But help us think then about Tuesday, and from your conservative perspective,
how you see it.
What's going
to be most interesting about this election is it would appear if you read the press and you read both the conservatives and the liberals that there is some kind of culture war going on in this country. Mm. And I'm part of that, and people like me are part of that, and I'm sure David Halberstam, who's coming on this program, would consider himself part of it. But the question is whether the American people really are taking part in this culture war, and to what extent.
When they vote, are they not necessarily taking part?
Not at all. They're not taking part when they vote. After all, when people vote, they have one of two choices, or in this case, one of three choices to vote for. This has been a very passionate and a very nasty campaign.
But if there's a culture war, Midge Dechter, and there are sides, and voters go in that booth, in effect, vote for a side, don't they become part of something?
Well, not necessarily. If it turns out, for instance, that the vote is, which it appears it's going to be, that the vote is a close vote, I would think this would suggest that the general populace is not engaged in this war the way, say, I am, and people on the other side are.
But why doesn't a close vote indicate
war with one another?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the system, the political system, has been apart from this, really, And I would like to think that it remains apart from this.
Apart from the culture war?
Apart from the culture war, yes. But ordinary Americans go to vote, and what those of us who are concerned with the general tenor and climate and so on of the country, I would hope that most people are busy going about their lives, too busy to really be paying much attention and taking part in this. I fear that what I say is not true. I fear that that the battles that have been going on in the universities, against the universities, the web logs against the Standard Press, all that, there's a tremendous hostility here in the climate where you and I are talking and where we spend our day, where we make a living, so to speak.
Yep, yep.
And I think I may be wrong, but I have a feeling we might find out that that does not go as deep in the American public as it does in those of us who make the noise.
Well, that raises so many questions. David Kennedy, I wish you'd join this subject, the issue of culture war. Do you see that behind or embedded in this vote next Tuesday? Midge Dechter hopes that people are going on about their business and are not so deeply involved in it, but yet that 50-50 nation can look very split. Is there a cultural, I don't know, battle that it is waged here? Is there a victory or loss on Tuesday? We certainly had a governing party, the White House and both houses of Congress, that's not been at all shy about pushing its cultural agenda.
Nor have its opponents.
Well, I mean, but in recent years, it's GOP right now, and there's no shyness. And you're quite right. A lot of fiery rhetoric on the other side. David Kennedy, how do you see it?
Well, I think Midge Dechter has just made a remarkable concession or admission that much of what we understand as the culture wars is really the product of a discrete number of voices in the media and so on. I believe very much in the findings of my Stanford colleagues, Mo Fiorina's recent book about this, that in fact, if you look at deep polling data about what people care about and believe in and so on, there's a remarkable consensus in the country about the things that really count. It's not an accident, it seems to me, that the issues that we identify as most divisive, the so-called social and cultural issues, abortion, affirmative action, stem cell research, school prayer, and so on, are known in the political business as wedge issues because they're the kind of thing that can drive a wedge into the electorate at the margin in a country that is very evenly divided across a broad spectrum of other issues. So I agree absolutely. I think the average citizen going to the polls on Tuesday brings a whole basket of concerns to that moment of decision. Very few voters, some, but very few, are driven by their attachment to a single issue of a high-voltage moral charge, such as these cultural and social issues are. And that, to that extent, we are still in an era of politics as normal, where voters have all kinds of concerns and try to balance them out as they make their decision in the polling place.
But those political leaders that they're voting for have agendas, and on both sides, they fight pretty viciously for them.
Well, yes, they campaign pretty viciously. I don't think, look, I mean, you would think from listening to this discussion, because this is such a heated campaign, that the country was the country was not the most longest lived and most stable democracy in the world, but it is, which has to mean that most ordinary people go about their lives. And it's one of the things that keeps this country stable. By the culture war, I wasn't talking about abortion and stem cell research only. I was talking about something larger. I was talking about what goes on in the universities. The university in which you teach was once the scene of a parade of people storming around and saying, ho, ho, hey, hey, ho, ho, Western culture's got to go.
You're talking about Stanford there.
Yeah, and that was almost 20 years ago. And that was an episode vastly amplified in the national media.
Of course.
In the culture wars.
Very little consequence on the campus.
But of course it was. And I sincerely hope that the Hollywood characters who are out preaching to us about how we should conduct our lives and how we should vote are not taken seriously, because I don't think they're very serious.
Well, I repeat, I think this is an important point. I think much of the so-called culture war is the property of the chattering classes and does not cut all that deeply through broad swaths of the electorate.
No, it doesn't, except at critical times. The chattering classes, whom everybody thought didn't cut deeply, did create a terrible schism in this society over the Vietnam War, for instance.
And it feels to me as though there may be one right now, and voters have to go out and vote into
that
atmosphere next
see.
Week.
That's what we're going to see about this war, which is rather different.
Mitch Dechter, wonderful to have you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been very nice.
Essayist and social critic Mitch Dechter, author of Rumsfeld, a personal portrait. Joining us now from New York City, David Halberstam, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and historian, prolific author of, among others, The Best and the Brightest, The Making of a Quagmire, America and Vietnam During the Kennedy Era, and War in a Time of Peace, Bush, Clinton, and the Generals. David Halberstam, good evening. Welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining
nice
us.
Nice to be with you, yes.
We're picking up this issue of just how important an election this may be.
I think it's obviously very important for the vast differences because of Iraq, because of post-9/11, because of things like economic and tax policy, a sense, for example, that the Republican Party, as it's now constituted, sort of the rove young Bush people really almost want to put an end to the last of the New Deal. I think these things are all out there, and I think the cultural thing is also very important. I would agree that most Americans in the vast center, which, by the way, does not mean a large a body of the society that has much to do with the nominating process of either party, is concerned about more elemental things than the culture wars. I think they're concerned about security and economics and jobs. But I would dissent from what Mitch Dechter said about, you know, that it hasn't gotten into the political system, that it's more separate. I don't think you can get, for example, the Republican nomination without, in effect, getting the approval and getting past a veto of the fundamentalist party. I think the Republican Party is a profoundly changed party from the party that existed in the 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s, and changed dramatically really in the last 20 years. And the power of the fundamentalists has grown greatly, and traditional sort of mainstream, sort of economically conservative Republicans really cannot get the nomination. And I think that brings that politicized, and comparably on the other side, there are certainly issues that anybody seeking the Democratic nomination will have to, certain constituencies that you have to salute, but I think it's very profound on the Republican side, and that brings it, and that brings the culture wars, which are very important to some of these people, into the center and puts it before us, whether the center wants those choices or not.
David Halberstam, Mitch Dechter was saying, look, you've got a very long-lived democracy here, the most stable in the world over a long period of time, and we should take from that a kind of confidence that stability goes on. Yet, as David Kennedy's pointed out, there have been very large forks in the road for the American democracy. Do you see kind of a big choice here that will define the country for a long period?
I think this is really, I think the differences are very considerable. And if you look back to Eisenhower and Stevenson, it looks, given the general view in foreign policy, given Eisenhower's essential sort of political centrism, for example, going back 52 years, that does not look in retrospect like a huge chasm between them, or even, you know, what seemed like a big difference at the time, Kennedy and Nixon in 1960. I mean, Nixon was in the political center, turned out to be really in effect in much of his domestic policy to be relatively liberal. Kennedy was a relatively centrist Democrat coming to the end of the New Deal. I think that whether it's on social policy, I think there's a significant break in foreign policy with the rather aggressive pursuit of a war in Iraq. I think using 9/11 as a lever to drive that through a rather intimidated Democratic Party and an intimidated media. But I think the differences are very, very significant in this election, and that's why it is bitter. I think the politics get more bitter when it gets so cultural. I think it's kind of like a family fight. I think this is a very big election. I would suspect that the turnout is going to be dramatically greater than 4 years ago or 8 years ago or 12 years ago.
And let me ask you this, David Halberstam. You've described American life in the 50s and American leadership in the 60s. You spent a lot of time looking at this country. Look ahead for us a bit then. If there's a big choice here, what's the broad stroke? What's the America you see emerging from a Bush victory, from a Kerry victory?
Well, I think, first of all, I think it's going to be a very angry country. I mean, half the people in the country are probably going to be very angry. I think our politics, for a variety of reasons, the nature of the issues, the particular kind of campaigning we do with sound bites and television commercials is just meaner of spirit. The decline of party disciplines, which kept people in line. In fact, you are now rewarded for being sort of sharper-edged in your commercials. I think there's going to be an anger on both sides that will kind of, in effect, make what happened in Florida and the Democratic anger over the Florida election seem mild. I think these, George W. Bush is elected, I think you'll have a continuation of the war in Iraq and greater dissidence on that. If, and of course, I think you have And if Senator Kerry is elected, I think you'll begin to see some form of trying to pull back, get out, use other nations or the UN or NATO to get in to pull us back, and you'll see a lot of anger over that, some of which will reflect some of the anger that took place post-Vietnam over the Vietnam War, which we're still living with now, 35 years or so after Senator Kerry as a young officer left there.
Yep.
I think we have fault lines that run through us that are really, I think we're meaner of spirit in some way politically than we used to be.
We've got to take a short break here. I want to come back and try and picture the two Americas, if that's the right way of looking at this, that could emerge from a Bush victory or from a Kerry victory. We're joined tonight by two Pulitzer Prize winners, David Halberstam and David Kennedy. You can join this conversation as well. What is riding on the Bush-Kerry contest on this election this year? Is this the biggest vote in your lifetime or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about next Tuesday's election and just how important it is. You can join the conversation. How do you size up the consequence of the 2004 presidential election? And with taxes already cut and the country already at war, have the big issues already been decided this year? How will history define the choice Americans make next week? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're delighted to be joined by two Pulitzer Prize winners tonight from Stanford, California, David Kennedy, author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, and from New York, David Halberstam, author most recently of War in a Time of Peace, Bush, Clinton, and the Generals. Tom's calling right now from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Just great, yeah, thanks.
These are my concerns, and I certainly think that there's a lot at stake in this election. This is probably the biggest election I've ever been involved in, and I'm 50 years old.
Okay.
And these are my concerns, because I think that this election has the possibility of reaffirming that a minority of Americans can elect a president that might be intolerant of and disenfranchise the majority, who also may structurally change America as we know it, including the economy, our relationship with foreign people, our civil justice system, a reordering of our environmental position and how we treat our environment, among many things. And when you mentioned taxes, and I think that's one too, but it goes far beyond that. And even the relationship between church and state. And I think that our president has, if he's reelected, will aggressively pursue that agenda, regardless of whether it is the agenda of the majority.
Tom, let me ask you, do you see then, in a Bush reelection, a different country coming out of this vote? Do you think you've got a lot of fellow Americans who want that different country?
I think that the majority of Americans do not want all of those things. Perhaps there are a lot of people who are one-issue, see this as one-issue elections, but overall, I think Americans don't want all those changes. I don't think the majority of Americans want those. But I think this president will take it upon himself to declare this a mandate, even with the minority of votes, to go ahead and do those things.
But he may very well have a majority by next Tuesday night. We don't know. Tom, thanks very much for your call. David Kennedy, how about this? I mean, I guess what makes people see elections as important is the notion that they may be transformational, that they could transform the country. Do you see that possibility here?
Well, yeah, and I think, yes, I do, and I think Tom has just nicely described some of the major items that are at stake here. And I do think, I agree with him, that a Bush victory will be understood by Bush and the Republican Party as a ratification of the doctrines of preemption and unilateralism abroad, and it will be understood as a mandate to advance down the road of dismantling a lot of the programs that were put in place by the New Deal and the Great Society of the 1930s and 1960s. So, and I also share his sense that probably a majority of the country, if they stop and think this thing through, don't really want to go very far down that road. There's been what we might call a kind of 9/11 displacement effect that I think President Bush has used very effectively. He has run as the Mr. National Security candidate, and most other things have been pushed to the margin. But as Tom rightly says, we have a whole array of relationships with the rest of the world that go beyond just matters of national security, important as that is, but they take in items like the environment and our economy and its international aspects and so on. And many of those things have just been shoved out to the margins as the Bush campaign has put this posturing as the only credible defenders of national security at the heart of its campaign. And that's been very powerful because of the psychological trauma of 9/11. But I think that if the country really thinks through carefully the whole the range of things that are at stake here, that Bush may not be reelected.
David Halberstam, what about the ballast that holds the country at some kind of accepted center? Can an election move it way off of that center and put us in a place we don't recognize?
Tom calling in spoke well, and as my old friend and colleague David Kennedy did, I think one of the interesting things is the parties in the past, both parties in elections past, were sort of pitched to get near the center. Mm. Now the nominating process, particularly seems to me in the Republican Party, is pitched to the extreme that a moderate candidate like the old Eisenhower Republicans, they're gone. Someone like Tom Kaine, liberal Republicans, George Romney couldn't run anymore. And I think
they're an endangered species.
I think one of the interesting things was that, George W. Bush ran as a, quote, compassionate conservative. He had the advantage of his father's name and the fact that his father was sort of a centrist Republican, had been part of the abiding tradition of bipartisanship with 9/11. He used the full leverage of that as if he'd been elected with a Johnsonian or an almost Reagan landslide, or the Nixon landslide of the second Nixon, the Nixon McGovern race. I mean, as if there was this extraordinary, he was able to maximize the change in America caused by that moment of great anxiety and vulnerability. And the issues that have flowed from that, however, many of which are still in the center, there's a great uneasiness. I mean, certainly everybody that I know of I live in New York, a city which was attacked, and that would, give the president a great deal of leverage, particularly on issues of terrorism. The attachment to Iraq, to that, is a very, very different thing. And I had a feeling when they went in, and the phrase I used was, we were punching our hand into the largest hornet's nest in the world, that we would not, as the administration claimed, be treated as liberators, that the movie they were watching in the White House was Patton, and the movie they should have been watching was on, you know, urban guerrilla warfare. And I think that we are now caught in something that is really very, you know, very upsetting to the vast center of Americans who are caught in it, are unhappy with it, and don't know what to do with it, about it.
David Kennedy, I know we have to let you go in just a minute. A final thought. You've looked closely at how far the country can move in one direction or another over time. How far, how radically can you imagine the United States culture, political culture, role in the world shifting as a result of Tuesday's vote?
Well, I think that the potential consequences are quite large. David Halberstam used the word radical, I think, quite correctly. You just used it, too. I think in many ways the agenda of the Bush administration is quite radical, both at home and abroad. And I think if elected, they will consider themselves to have a mandate to do some attempt, at least, to do some truly transformational things. One of the ways that that could play itself out very concretely is through the president's power to shape the federal judiciary, and, of course, most of all, the Supreme Court of the United States. And it's the conventional wisdom, which I believe is correct, is that the next president, whoever he is, will have the opportunity to appoint as many as three, possibly four Supreme Court justices.
Possibly four or five.
That could change the landscape going forward for quite
and
a long
the,
time.
And the district courts as well.
Yes, the entire structure of the federal judiciary.
So right on through. David Kennedy, I know we have to let you go, but we appreciate your big historian's view tonight, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
David Kennedy at Stanford University, author of Freedom from Fear. We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation with David Halberstam. Doug is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing, Tom?
Great. Thanks.
You know, I think this election is really, really, really important. I mean, obviously. Obviously, the country is very deeply divided, things like that. But honestly, I think that last election was almost a little bit more important because, I mean, you have neoconservatives, you know, like Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, people like that, who probably would not be where they are right now, you know, if it weren't for the last election. You know, Bush was pretty much Karl Rove's poster boy, essentially. And, you know, had he lost the last election, I really don't think that the country would be shoved as far right as it would be now, you know, very obviously.
So you think maybe the big change has already come. Doug, thanks for calling. David Halberstam, how about it? Is the die already cast as a result of the 2000 outcome?
It's partially cast. I mean, it was certainly partially cast, and certainly the country. I mean, we've had a series of presidents, and I think it's probably inevitable in a large democracy like this, who were probably not up to speed on terrorism. I don't think many of us were, and I'd include myself, I'd include the media, I'd include the Congress, and I would include presidents from both parties. I think changing major policy shifts in this country and foreign policy is sort of like trying to steer an aircraft carrier by trailing your hand in the water. You need traumatic events like that. But in 2000, it did not seem that wide a gap because Gore was a legatee of the Clinton administration, which was hardly a radical administration. It was kind of the new Democratic people. In fact, there were major reforms on welfare and issues like that. And George W. Bush really ran as a compassionate conservative and had the beneficiary of his father's, I think, rather centrist appeal. The father had done a very good job of coming to the end of the Cold War. A soft landing seemed to be in continuation of bipartisan policies and seemed to have very little, in fact, interest in domestic policies interest. So the George W. Bush, the more radical conservative administration that emerged, was post-election one. Now it seems that the split between the two forces is very clearly in front of the country, as it was not in 2000.
So you're saying this time would be an open sanction of that policy, which kind of emerged.
It would be very interesting to see, and particularly since the news from Iraq, I think, has been very, very, very disturbing for the last couple months, a sense that this thing really doesn't work.
Eve is calling from Magnolia, Massachusetts. Hi, Eve. You're on the air.
Hey, hey, Tom. How are you?
Hi. Great. Thanks.
Good. Yeah, I just wanted to hear some discussion around this stark imbalance of power at present. And
what do you mean by imbalance of power, Eve?
Well, the right has just such a firm clutch, you know, on power. It just really seems that the Republicans are in charge. And to me, it feels that it can, in fact, be very threatening to the nature of our democracy.
The Democrats were in charge of the White House and both houses of Congress for a long time. Was that threatening to democracy? Is this different?
I guess because I feel that the agenda has become, as the discussion has been going, so radical and aligned with very fundamentalist sort of principles, it feels scarier to me.
We've got it, Eve. Thanks for your call. David Halberstam, how about it? Eve raises it. You know it's on,
well,
it's on many people's minds.
I was 18 years old before I lived under a Republican president because I was born at the beginning of the New Deal. So, I don't think there is that great a Republican hold on the country. I certainly think that there was a momentary empowerment of a sitting president because of 9/11, because of September 11th. But I think the country is still very centrist. It is uneasy. It is torn between an anxiety about what we're doing in terms of the policy in Iraq, and yet fearful also of terrorism. There's a split personality there. It is not entirely confident of Bush. He is not going in on a kind of mandate the way Reagan would have had in a second term. On the other hand, it does not seem to me yet that Senator Kerry has crystallized himself to a lot of people in the center who might have had doubts. I think the issues are out there. People are still making up their decisions, and I think it's very interesting to live in a country now where the election is being fought primarily only in about 10 locales. That's something relatively new for me. When you went back, most of the country was up for stake. Now you have what I guess are called the nation of the contested state.
That's a radically
new thing.
David Halberstam, let me just ask you off of Eve's impulse there, and we've just got a minute left. But, you know, she's asking something that Senator Robert Byrd is raising. He's speaking in quite apocalyptic terms about a threat to democracy, a kind of Roman Empire-style shift from democracy to something else, something more imperial. Do you see the stakes that high here, or is Robert Byrd, is Eve overwrought?
I have a great faith in the elasticity and the resilience of this country, that when things seem dark, it's often light. When things seem light, it may be dark. I'm not apocalyptic. I think this is a difficult time. I think the assault of the terrorists brings home a confrontation which is extremely difficult because our normal means of power, our great scientific and technological military power, is generally not applicable against the terrorists. I think that we have done something rather reckless in Iraq and not used our power well. But I'm not apocalyptic. I merely have great faith in the country and its common sense and its ability to respond to issues. And I'm going to keep that faith with me, and I'm not going to be quite as apocalyptic as Senator Byrd. I really do think American democracy has a great constant capacity to surprise us, that we always underestimate ourselves and our belief in this free society. I have a lot of faith in that.
David Halberstam, we will try to keep that faith, but with a sharp eye on the vote. We're very grateful to you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
David Halberstam, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and historian, author most recently of War in a Time of Peace. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.